Coming up on this week's show, big news for fans of Stunt Car Racer.
An impressive new platformer lands on the C64.
And an easy trick to fix your PSP display.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you every week with our good friends at Bitmap Books. Now, have you checked out their latest volume? So interesting. Leaps and Bounds, a visual guide to 9 console generations. Now, this massive new book charts the history of home video game consoles, exploring how the 9 generations of hardware transformed our living rooms, connected communities around the world, and basically shaped modern entertainment, blending expert insight, incredible illustrations, and that striking design that you've come to know from Bitmap Books, and celebrates iconic systems, bold experiments, and the forgotten flops, and technological leaps that defined gaming culture. Get your copy right now at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 528, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And very nice to have you joining us as we geek out for the next hour or so about all the big happenings in the world of retro gaming and technology, update you on all the big stories that have been landing on our timelines, and of course, welcome on a veteran of the industry, like we do every week, for an interview on the show to tell us their story. And this week, definitely one for the Atari and Sinclair fans. We'll tell you more about that in just a minute. Hoping that I actually don't look too jet-lagged, I don't think, Dora, after my travels.
Trying to fake it. We all know that we're recording this beforehand.
Yes.
Yeah, you're supposed to be out in America at the moment, aren't you?
Yeah, which I am. But yeah, so I did record this before we went out there. So yeah, I've just been to VCF East in New Jersey, which is a great event. You've been to before, Ravi. Yeah. I was there last year as well. And by the time this podcast comes out, I will have been there last weekend. So if you did come along to the event, maybe you come to say hello to me as well. Always great meeting people there as well. I'll obviously chat more about the event when I'm back next week. But yeah, hopefully that went really well. And I can bring you some of the panels from that too on the podcast in the future. You guys last weekend would have been out at the Nottingham Gaming Market. So I'm sure you met a few people there as well. But that does really mean, I mean, you know, these two events, start of event season for us, because the calendar pretty much gets chocker over the summer, doesn't it? With all the events that we go to, pretty much something every month coming up. I think next one's going to be, well, it'll be your event, Ravi, won't it? All Roads Lead to Derby.
Yeah, All Roads Lead to Derby. The Amiga is back, baby. So this is an event that I've done for the third time. This will be the third time. It's the UK Amiga Expo. So this is a huge one called Kickstart. And any Amiga fan and any fan of, you know, general old school amazing games.
You have Atari there, and I think you've got some Amstrad stuff this year. It's not exclusively Amiga.
Some Acorn stuff as well, yeah. So, you know, we have other systems they're allowed, but mainly we have like talks and traders and guests. You know, this is a full expo, and the list is pretty amazing. I've just got to say, I'm just going to read who we've got coming, because we've got quite a lot of companies for some amazing games in the Amiga world. So Alistair Brimble from Team 17, of course, composer of Alien Breed, Andy Davidson from Team 17, creator of Worms, Frank Sawyer from Art and Magic's coming along, Agony Unreal, which, you know, were absolutely stunning games. He's flying in and coming to a show for the first time in the UK. Simon Phipps as well, of Core Designs, so a local company to Derby. You know, he did Rick Dangerous, which was an absolutely amazing one, plus loads of other amazing art. Billy Allison's coming as well from Core Designs, did Bubba and Sticks.
I did him on the other way, didn't I?
Yeah. Steve Hammond from DMA Designs, one of your favourites, did Hired Guns and Lemmings 2, My Daily as well. Grand Theft Auto, Lemmings as well, and Colin Proudfoot is coming from America, so the former MD Commodore UK, and our main guest is the father of Amiga DOS, so the guy who created the Amiga disk operating system is coming, Dr. Tim King, and he did that in Cambridge University from Tripos, which was a really early kind of operating system.
So the talks are amazing at Kickstart. Yeah, fantastic line. We've got Boat, haven't you, from the Amigos podcast, who's coming over to
host.
I'm going to be hanging out with the VCF, actually. Looking forward to meeting him in person again. But also you do the big traders area there as well, and the after party as well, which I think, you know, I'm looking forward to that. I actually got my mate, Steve, I used to work with about 20 years ago. And we used to have like Amiga gaming nights when I kind of got back into the Amiga around 2007. And he was an Amiga fan when he was a kid. And we've been messaging each other on Facebook recently. He's got his hands on an Amiga 600 again, and he's coming to Kickstart.
Oh, so nice.
I'm looking forward to having a few drinks with my old mate again and geeking out about the Amiga. So what are the dates for that and how do we get tickets?
Yeah, so that's the 7th and 8th of August, and that's at the Reach Conference Centre in Derby. So right next to Pride Park, the football stadium. And to get tickets by going to amigashow.com.
And then after that, heading out to Norway. The next one is Retro Messa, which is always so much fun. This will be like our 7th time there now, I think. Yeah, we're definitely part of the furniture now.
I love Retro Messa. Such a lovely event. It's great we get to see all our Scandinavian listeners. Some of the guests that we've had on the podcast have been absolutely stunning. You know, people we wouldn't usually be able to talk to, but the guys at Retro Messa take us out there, and it's just fantastic. Such a good event, amazing community, amazing vibes there.
Just three guys. We're all going to be there this year, happening August 15th to 16th. Over that weekend.
Paul Jury's coming along as well.
Retro Gamer magazine. Yeah. Dragged him along last year and he had such a good time. He's like, oh, please bring me back. And he was actually great on stage. So awesome week of anywhere near that area. Sandefjord in Norway. If you're not, it's worth a flight in as well. Really good event. So we'll link these in the show notes and there more to come over the summer. Now, I did kind of touch on the start there that we have a pretty good episode this week if you're a fan of Atari and Sinclair, because we're going to be chatting to a guy who is, I say a lot of people call him the father of the Atari Jaguar. Now, this is John Matheson. Now, John's got a really interesting history. Graduated from Cambridge in 1981 and then went straight into one of Britain's leading computer companies, straight into Sinclair, as the ZX Spectrum was in development.
Literally walked into it, which is pretty amazing, you know, hanging around with Clive Sinclair and doing some really technical hardware stuff, which is John's speciality.
Yeah, and even working on Sinclair Basic as well when he first got there, and also working on a really mythical Sinclair product called the Loki that I've heard about for years. It's kind of rumored that that was a console that Sinclair were working on. And, you know, we've also heard that, you know, Clive Sinclair kind of, he turned his nose up at games, you know, Jet Set Beeping Willy. You know, he was in the business side of it, wasn't he? So interesting to hear a little bit about that and kind of, the technical goals of Loki and what it was really meant to be, because there's a lot of conflicting information online about it. It's interesting to hear it a bit more from John, who actually worked on it himself. And then also following his progress from when Amstrad took over Sinclair, then he left the company and founded his own company then, working with a few other former Sinclair engineers and working on an architecture called the Flair One chipset that went into the ill-fated Konix multi-system, which is interesting to hear about, isn't it? Because,
you know, I'd heard of Flair a lot before and really interesting history there, how their technology got used, but then it also got used in a few like multimedia arcades as well. Mm. And it was a bit like a step up from the Amiga. It's a bit further on the way they were developing things. But
heavily based on the Amiga, though, wasn't it, after they saw it? A cheaper version they wanted to make.
And it's interesting because we talked to John, you know, he's amazing. He ended up going to NVIDIA at the end. But he does say he's kind of like got a history of working for failed consoles, which Dan, you absolutely love and we find that fascinating on the podcast. So the Konix is one that we always talk about. But then, of course, going into the Atari Jaguar and later the new one as well, which was that obscure DVD one. And there seems to be a great history here where people like Jeff Minter have been around him throughout his career, going in and out of the different companies.
You're right. I always do like a good tech tragedy. You know, kind of what could have been. So I think, you know, in terms of John, I mean, you mentioned he's been at NVIDIA for like over 25 years now. So I think NVIDIA are doing all right at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah, he's
doing
all right,
I'm pretty sure they're still doing pretty well. But yeah, I think it's just a lot of his story seems to be just the technology was kind of wrong place, wrong time. Because the actual tech behind it was really good. It's just a series of misfortunes, you know, Konix kind of running out of money, Atari, the marketing kind of let the system down. But we do talk to John about how, you know, certain games on the Jaguar, when you see like John Carmack's version of Doom that he actually made for the Jaguar, see someone actually programming the hardware and making the custom chip sing in
people
there.
People who knew how to use it and pushed it to its limits. And,
yeah.
And that's what we kind of talk about. Because, you know, there was a lot of kind of sloppy ports and stuff like that. But when it was done really well, it was fantastic.
Yeah, and I'm a Jag fan, so it's always interesting to hear a bit more about the development of that system and much more as well. So if you're listening to the audio podcast, John will be coming up on part two of the show. If you're watching on YouTube, you'll get that as a separate video early next week. But of course, first bit of the podcast, that's when we have a bit of a chat about the news, the big stories that have been landing in our timelines over the last week. Now, weirdly, there's been two big stories about the Jeff Crammen game, the classic stunt car racer. You ever play this on the Amiga back in the day, Ravi?
All the time, yeah. It felt like a very old school game compared to the stuff that was out there. But it was all about the physics, wasn't it? It wasn't so much about the graphics. I think I always used to blow my engine up, revving it too much.
The steam coming out of it, yeah.
Yeah, it was good once you got to know the courses. Enjoyable fun, but I think it was like a reflection of a certain time period of gaming, you know. It did seem a lot like old hat, but it's like a classic with a lot of Amiga users.
Well, it was an 8-bit title as well. The Commodore 64 version, I think, was probably more technically impressive.
Didn't we discuss a Spectrum port at one point as well? I'm sure somebody's done.
Yeah, there is a Spectrum version of it. There's an Amstrad version of it as well, Atari ST. So it came out on like pretty much everything in 1989, all the mainstream platforms. But I think, yeah, in terms of the Commodore 64, that kind of use of 3D vector graphics really pushed that system. But the Amiga version, I think, you know, that was a version that I played. And if you haven't played it, it's basically it's a racing game where you you basically play on. It's almost like a roller coaster track,
yeah,
isn't
you're
it?
Just when you're bombing it, you're bombing it around a track, doing jumps and trying not to wreck your car, basically.
But one thing I always found with Stunt Car Racer is the frame rate on it. You know, playing it on an Amiga 500 wasn't all that smooth. I think it was locked in at 15 FPS, and there have been people who wanted a smoother experience playing Stunt Car Racer. So people bought, you know, accelerator cards for the Amiga and then were disappointed to see that the game actually is hard locked at 15 FPS. So even if you're running it on like an Amiga 1200 or whatever, you're still going to get that kind of jerky frame rate.
I go for that jerky frame rate. There's nothing like the thrill of doing a jump at 15 or 14 frames per second and try to land it accurately.
Until you can't go boom, ride. Yeah. Well, it
the
turns out
thrill ride.
Not everybody has been thrilled with those, you know, low frame rate graphics. So there's been an effort. A guy called Vincent GR has put this together, and someone called Visuri. There's a video of it you can watch here. It's basically made a smooth 50/60 FPS frame rate version of Stunt Car Racer. So this unlocks the frame rate, but it doesn't modify the speed or the physics of the game. So if you watch the video, the side-by-side video that Vincent GR's put up on YouTube, I'll link that in the show notes as well. You can see what Visuri's done here. Really, I mean, this is designed for Amigas with accelerators. But what it does is it kind of unlocks a game so it can take advantage of like the faster CPU. Yeah. So it looks really smooth.
WHD load slave, isn't it, as well? So you just kind of replace the slave file and it gives that unlock. And I'd like to see this happen for more games, actually, unlocking the FPS, because there were those limitations and you got your more memory and your faster machine and stuff would still play slowly. I think it looks good. I still prefer the old one. just the noise.
Well, it won't change the noise of it. Yeah, the sounds will stay the same. It's literally just the graphics that look smoother now. So you're basically getting more frames. I think it looks like a much more enjoyable game playing it. It does, even though they say it doesn't modify the speed of the game obviously with more frames, it just feel faster, I think, watching the video. But I mean, if you have got a faster Amiga and you wanted a smoother version of it, it's saying it is still a work in progress. So consider this a beta version, and he's going to distribute the source code. So, you know, when it's finished, it'll be out there. But really, to install it's pretty straightforward. All you do is, if you've got Stunt Car Racer, the WHD load slave on your Amiga, you replace the slave file with the one that he provides with this modification, and then the game will run a lot smoother if you have the hardware to support it. So I think it's something that a lot of people wanted, and it does run. You don't need AGA or anything like that, or a graphics card. It will run on like a, you know, if you have an accelerated Amiga 500 or a 2000 or a 3000, you know, you'll be able to experience a smoother game. So I think it's very cool to see. Obviously, someone who wanted it to be a smoother experience back in the day can now finally have that. Not the only bit of news for Stunt Car Racer fans this week, though. Someone did point out that, and I'd completely forgotten about this, you know, Stunt Car Racer was a null modem game. Did you ever play any null modem games?
No, I wasn't that cool. I didn't have any friends to connect with. I think I played one later, which was like Lotus, and I think you could play that between the Atari ST and the Amiga. But yeah, this looks like it's a multiplayer version of Stunt Car Racer that's using that null modem link, but doing it online, basically.
Yeah, or in browser. So at the moment, yeah, this is it's multi-stunt car, which is from a Retro Foundry, which is basically a version of Stunt Car Racer that you can play completely in your web browser. But he does mention in his blog here that he always wanted to try Stunt Car Racer as a head-to-head game. Obviously, the way he did it back then was by linking two Amigas together by a serial port link and the modem cable. He could never get it to work when he was a kid. So he said one of the ways he thought a much more practical way to do it would be a split screen that you can just basically play on your web browser. So that's what this is. You can, you know, two people can play on a keyboard, play it in your browser, go head-to-head playing Stunt Car Racer. He said there is also a kind of remote version of this that's built around screen sharing, but it's a bit more experimental. So if you kind of want that old school null modem feel to it, then that is in there as well. But yeah, I think, you know, the fact that you can basically play head-to-head Stunt Car Racer locally in your web browser on your machine, I think very cool. So if you're a fan of the older Jeff Kramman classic, a very good month for Stunt Car Racer fans. If you want to check out both of those projects, I'll put them in this week's show notes. Now, if we're talking about huge series from back in the day, they don't come much bigger than Pokemon. And do we see Pokemon fan games very often? I always feel like it might be a bit of a difficult kind of thing to get around. Obviously, I imagine they're quite protective of the license of Pokemon.
You do get them. I don't know how quickly they get taken down. And I don't know if you guys have heard of, this isn't the story, but the game Pow World, which has been around for a year or two, which is a real official game, and they're being sued by Nintendo because of, it's basically Pokemon, with other mechanics in it, such as guns, but that's like a capturing monsters RPG game, which is basically Pokemon, and Nintendo are trying to sue them to high heaven. That's been ongoing for a couple of years now. But yeah, this is a fan game that is doing the rounds. And, you know, we're not usually one to talk much about Pokemon. You know, I think I just caught the end of the Pokemon craze when I was younger, and played the original games and loved them, you know, but it's definitely something I don't really follow these days. But we thought we'd give this one a mention, which is Pokemon Adventure, which is a fan game that's just got its first demo. But like I say, it's doing the rounds on a lot of the places we get our news from, Retro Dodo, etc. Because apparently it's a bit of a more darker version of Pokemon. And interestingly, it's set around the first game where it all started, which is the Kanto region, where Pokemon...
Which is where I started.
Which is where I started as well. Where I ended. but yeah, it's based on the Kanto region. Which is where the original Pokemon games in the 90s were set. But it's a darker story, and apparently it's about Pokemon have started attacking people.
That really scares me. It's like they've got rabies or something.
Yeah.
Nightmares now.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense.
Such a dark concept, though.
That dragons become sentient and start attacking me. Yeah. It doesn't want to be captured in a Pokeball anymore.
I shouldn't have collected them all.
Yeah, basically. but it follows the same premise. There's eight gym leaders which is like the classic games. And you meet people along the way who help you, etc. And, you know, you still collect Pokemon. And it's been created by a developer called Neto BR Games. And he's named the main character of himself, Neto or Neto, who's a 12-year-old boy traveling the world with his Squirtle, which was actually my favorite Pokemon, which is quite nice. So, and was one of the original Pokemon, starter Pokemons from the original game.
Oh, I hope in this game Squirtle doesn't eat you, though. That'd really...
No, I don't think he does. Okay. I think your Pokemon are friendly.
He stays nice, okay.
And the events... Now, this is where it doesn't mean much to me. They take place... before the events that took place in Gala, which I'm assuming is another region in Pokemon, which is when Pokemon Sword and Shield are set. Now, I did actually try to play Pokemon Sword a couple of years ago because I went on holiday and I bought it for my Switch. And unfortunately, I couldn't really get into it. I thought I wanted to recapture, you know, that kind of like the original Pokemon games. And I didn't know what any of the Pokemon were and I had no nostalgia for any of them. So I didn't get too far in it. But it's set before that happened. So I'm assuming this is after the original Pokemon games. But we're revisiting that area. Something dark and scary is happening that's making the Pokemon attack people. But what's interesting about it as well, because I always kind of see the Pokemon games as like, you know, they're an RPG game that gets you into RPGs. You know, they've got very, to a degree.
Gateway drug.
Yeah, it's a gateway drug of RPGs, and they've got, you know, some basic RPG elements in there. Some of the newer ones have probably got much more in-depth RPG elements. But what's interesting about this is it's got 10 endings planned for the game as well. Yeah, so at the moment, it's a demo. But when the game is finished, there'll be 10 possible endings.
And it looks to me like, obviously, I've played the Pokemons on OG Game Boy.
Yeah.
I got up to Silver, I think it was.
Yeah.
And this looks like it's more maybe DS.
Yeah, this looks themed more
in the look of it, but the world is still recognizable, like especially those tree lines and
yes.
You know how it's kind of set out. So I can imagine it's been a bit DS-ified. I don't know, is it available for that system?
No, it's a PC game.
It's PC. Yeah. So yeah. I'm telling Porky's I did play through Pokemon Black, which was for the DS in 2010, but I don't really remember it.
Pokemon Stadium, I played that as well, I think.
Yeah, I played Pokemon Stadium for the N64 as well. But yeah, this graphically, it looks kind of around the Game Boy Advance / DS games, doesn't it? So I imagine it probably takes a lot of the sprites and, you know, artwork from that. But it's, you know, hopefully Nintendo don't come along.
You know, you know what, though?
Yeah.
I don't want to be a downer here. You know, before we started reading this story, there is a link to the demo on the Poke Community website, but I've now refreshed and has suddenly gone in the last 2 minutes.
Oh, God. It happened in real time on the show. I know.
So that's pretty bad if so. Might this be a glitch with it? They said they're doing some updates regarding accounts.
Yeah, I've just clicked on it. Yeah, it's gone.
Yeah, it was literally there 5 minutes ago.
Oh, God. So, hopefully it's just an update.
It's tough as well because, you've got stuff like the sound and all of that that, obviously, Nintendo could go on. Yeah.
We do.
I could do Pokemon impressions. Goldeen. Send them in just to stop Nintendo.
That'll tide everyone over till the demo comes back up. Yeah. So fingers crossed. Like we said, it is just a glitch, but I'm sure there are places you can find it if you want to play it. But it looks very cool if you're a Pokemon fan. Nice to get some homebrew. This looks very cool as well. We have been talking about the Commodore 64 quite a lot on the podcast recently, and impressive new titles that are landing on that platform. And I thought this was worth a shout out as well, because this is a really impressive new platform adventure game for the Commodore 64 from just one developer. Marcel Sasik is a guy's name, NTPR he goes by, who's basically done the lot by the sounds of this. He's done, you know, the coding for it, the graphics, the sound effects, the story as well. Hans Svala has worked on the soundtrack with him as well. But this looks like a fantastic, technically brilliant game for the Commodore 64. Now, this is called Christian and the Lost Crystals, which at the moment it is a game that's in development right now. And you can check out the website and you can buy this for $3.99. And the story is that Christian is an ordinary boy who never cared much for stones. Everything changed during an expedition with his uncle George, a renowned geologist. Deep within his mines, Christian excitedly discovered his first shimmering crystals. So, yeah, it's one of those kind of set in caves kind of games. A bit, you know, in the vein of Boulder Dash or something like that. But I think in terms of gameplay on it, what impresses me about it is just the amount of sprites that are on screen at the same time.
So they've gone for the choice of not big ones like a lot of other games. It's massively zoomed out.
Yeah.
So you've got a lot of action. And I don't know if you ever played a game called Benefactor for the Amiga. It reminds me of that, where it's zoomed out and you've got a really small character. But, you know, the scenery is doing a lot of work and the environment. And it's quite good, actually, because some of these titles where they're platformers, you're lost at the edge of the screen. Or, you know, you're jumping into an area that you don't know. Being able to see that and explore, it does make you feel like you're in this kind of cave world. And I think it's beautifully done, actually. It's it seems, I don't know, very round or very curvy, which I don't usually associate with the C64, you know, curves.
It's got that console kind of style look to it.
Yeah, but it's got like a hand-drawn kind of, you know, even the text, the way that it's written is, it looks like it's kind of hand-drawn. Beautifully done, I think the artwork is, and the way that it's moving as well. You've got so much moving on the screen at the same time.
I think as well, what's really impressive about this is he says on his itch page that this is, he's just starting out. So, I mean, the fact that he's making something like this already on the C64. Again, it's got that, I mean, some people have kind of complained that it looks a bit dark and brown. It is a Commodore 64 game at the end of the day, so he's working
live
with
in the dark and brown. Yeah,
I mean, you know, the constraints of the colour palette, but I think, yeah, technically it looks really impressive. I haven't played this yet, but it is something I'm going to buy for my Commodore 64 Ultimate that's sat next to me. You can play an original C64 or on the Vice emulator, one of the many other emulators on the 64. There's been a few updates to it as well. The one complaint that I've kind of seen is the controls apparently take quite a bit of getting used to. But once you've mastered it, then it's, some people say it plays really well. But yeah, there is a bit of a learning curve there. So yeah, I mean, it looks like it might be one of those kind of, you've got to be a bit pixel perfect on your jumps.
I'm not sure where this developer's from, but it does seem maybe French to me, or it's just got a kind of Euro style in there. Really like it. Really like the look of it. For some reason it reminds me of Another World a bit, in a C64 way.
Well, there are three graphically rich locations filled with traps and dangerous enemies. Like we mentioned, full of animation, loads of motion on screen as well. It's a explore the maze kind of game, which gradually reveals itself. Over 60 enemies in each location, which is pretty nice for a Commodore 64 game. Loads of different types as well. So, you know, it was quite common on the 64 that you play a game where, you know, you face the same enemy over and over again. There's a puzzle element to it as well, but it's quite simple. And, you know, like a lot of old school games, collect the coins, get 100 coins, that equals an extra life as well. And also bonuses for energy and other pickups as well. So I think, yeah, in terms of, if you want a good, like, kind of arcade adventure, you know, style platformer for the C64 for the sake of $4, I mean, absolutely give this a go.
He's Slovakian, actually, and he's also done some other titles as well, Blob, Hex, and Super Pac-Man.
Oh, fantastic. So, it looks really impressive. So definitely one that I will be getting for my Commodore 64. If you're a C64 owner, I implore you to do the same. So I'll link up the itch page in this week's show notes. Now, we're going to be talking about a little hack that some people have found. If you have a PSP or a Nintendo DS with a yellowing display, which is apparently a bit of a problem. And also some news of a product that you might not want to buy, but we'll talk more about that in a second. Before we do, let's take a moment to give a massive thank you to a regular supporter of our podcast, as our friends at Shopify. And Ravi, do the noise.
Why do I have to do the noise?
You know the noise.
Ka-ching!
That's it. Ka-ching! The sound of making money. Now, if you have a Shopify account, you'll love hearing that. That means you've made a sale on Shopify because it is the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. And the great thing about Shopify is they're there to support businesses of any size. I mean, you know, massive companies, Mattel, Gymshark, they're powered by Shopify, but also the small guys as well. You know, we sell our books on Shopify. You know, my missus has been selling some of her arts and crafts on there as well. I've got a mate who does t-shirts on there. So really, however big your business is or however big you want to grow, Shopify will be there every step of the way. And the great thing is, I mean, you know, Ravi, you've done web design and support for many years. Now, do you remember what it was like back in the bad old days, trying to configure your own WordPress plugins and do your own e-store? And
updates,
that kind of thing?
Plugins, and the store would just collapse at certain times and people would be ringing you up. You know, this was e-commerce was a very hard thing to do, and Shopify just makes it massively easy. 16K plus apps. So, you know, you don't just need to sell through there. You can do loads of other stuff as well. It's got online courses, which really help out as well. I find it fantastically easy to use. We had stuff like automated shipping in there as well. So you could print out the labels, get all your kind of inventory stock, streamlines the process, really.
The amount of time that saved you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. Got one of those thermal printers and was just firing them out, but also digital delivery as well, which meant people would get it instantly. And it's all really safe and secure through the checkout. There's discount codes as well, which is fantastic. So you can keep track of your items that you're actually selling, see what's selling, start campaigns, work with social media. It's just really good. Like, there's so many people that use it as well. Bitmap Books, one of our sponsors, uses it. And it's just fantastic. Gymshark as well.
Anyone can set up a shop on there as well, because it's so easy to use. It's all drag and drop. They give you this gorgeous design studio with hundreds of ready-to-use templates that then you can match to your brand style, your fonts, your colors as well. Like you mentioned, their marketing tools are really impressive as well, because that's something a lot of businesses neglect. You know, you're that into making your product, you forget that, you know, you could have the best product in the world, but if no one knows about it, you're not going to sell any. But with Shopify, it's like having a marketing team working with you. They help you create easy email and social media campaigns. Wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling, they'll be there with you as well. It's like having a commerce expert with world-class expertise with everything from managing inventory, international shipping, and processing returns when you need that as well. And if you ever need any support, their award-winning 24/7 customer support is available too. So if you sell anything at all, you need to give Shopify a try. And actually, we didn't mention, you get that iconic purple Shop Pay button. It's used by millions of businesses all around the world on your website. And actually, that's been proven to be the best converting checkout on the planet. So that will help you boost your conversions, less carts go abandoned, and more sales for you as well. So why don't you give Shopify a try? We've got you an amazing no-brainer offer. So you can try it out for £1 a month. Absolutely worth a go. Use our link. Helps out the podcast. Know that we sent you. Shopify.co.uk/retrohour. That is shopify.co.uk/retrohour. I'll put it in this week's show notes and get ready to hear a lot more of this. Now, I've got a PSP and a DS. You guys got any of those consoles in your collection?
Got a DSi and a 2DS. I've had a PSP.
Nintendogs.
Nintendogs.
You play that. Yeah.
System seller. I haven't turned mine on for a while, though, and I'm a little bit concerned now, because apparently, I wasn't aware that this was a problem, but apparently if you own a Nintendo DS or a Sony PSP, over time, the displays can apparently develop a bit of a yellow tint. I imagine, you know, can be slightly annoying if you're playing on it regularly. You know, a yellow filter over all your games.
Yeah, I saw this article and I read the headline about the yellow tinting and I was like, I don't recall. And then I clicked into the pictures and I was like, oh no, yeah, definitely seen DSs with that on there. It's a yellow tint that comes from the corners of the screen, basically on the bottom screen. I think it can happen to the top screen. But when I saw the pictures, I was like, Oh, yeah. No, I've definitely seen a lot, and I mean a lot of DSs without the yellow tint. If anything, that's kind of like how a DS looks in my brain.
You just got used to it now.
Yeah, I've just got used to it, especially with them being, you know, over 20 years old now. The DS and DSIs are like 20 years old. But yeah, all is not what it seems, apparently.
Because most people who were a bit annoyed by that yellow tint, they've been going out and buying replacement LCD screens.
Mm-hmm.
That obviously require a bit of expertise to kind of strip your console down, replace it, and expense as well. But it could be a lot easier than that. Now, this is a user on X called Wada Retro Game, who's made a discovery that apparently if you simply leave your console on a white screen for quite a while, that could sort out the yellowing issue and it goes back to white.
This, I don't understand it. So they're saying that it's not actually the screen, it's to do with the acrylic panel. But I don't know what they mean by that.
I think that on top of the screen, you've got acrylic layer.
Yeah,
right. The plastic, and the plastic within that, because it reacts to light and it gets exposed to light. I guess they're blasting it with light for like an extended period of time. And then...
like retro-brighting it.
That's like, it's staying within the acrylic or somehow kind of clearing it up when previously it would get a bit distorted or jaded, I guess.
Yeah.
That's guess on it, yeah.
That makes sense. I wasn't sure if it was like the inside, like the plastic, the around the edge of the screen. And like the side of that had yellowed, but I was like, but how would that, by leaving a white screen on it, how would that fix that? But from what you've just said, that makes more sense.
I think maybe in the center, it's probably more concentrated for whites that you get.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the edges, it's like darkening over time.
Yeah.
And that's the yellowing coming in.
Mm. And there's pictures here.
Having a full blast of it. Yeah.
Yeah. There's pictures here of users saying it's worked for them. There's a couple of people saying, it got slightly better for them. User's like, oh, it didn't really work for me. It only got slightly better. Well, it did work then because it got slightly better.
Slightly better is better than nothing.
I think it was when I looked at the pictures and I kind of realized like, oh yeah, it's not meant to have that like shadowy yellowness to it. It's meant to look much brighter than that. That's when I realized, that's not what a DS is meant to look like.
Yeah, I guess it's like the way that the plastic reacts over time. And it's interesting. It's always yellow with a console, isn't it?
They
turn yellow on the outside or it's yellow. Yeah. It never goes pink or anything like that.
It never goes purple. It's nice pretty color, purpling.
So, I mean, it could be a nice, that's the thing. Obviously, if you want like a permanent fix, I guess replacing that. The acrylic bit would be the best thing to do. As a temporary fix, it's worth a try, isn't it? Leave it on screen for an hour or two.
I guess instead of replacing the screen, you could probably, I don't know how the acrylic's attached to the screen though. It might be a real process. I remember redoing Game Boy screens and you had to scrape the whole back off and the way that it was all sandwiched together with Nintendo stuff on original Game Boy screens when you were doing like backlights and stuff. It can get quite complex, especially with the handhelds.
Yeah.
So maybe if this doesn't work, you might have to do a full replacement. I did a few mods on my PSP myself as well and put a new screen in there and ripped out the UMD drive and had a big fat battery in there and stuff, you know.
So I've got a really yellow Dreamcast. I just think if I put my telly on a white screen and sit the Dreamcast in front of it for a day, I think that'll restore my Dreamcast.
Might do.
We've discovered something new. So worth a try, though, if you've got one. Your mileage may vary, though. But we thought we'd point that out. Pretty cool. Now, that was pretty cool. This one, maybe not so cool. Did we cover this when it was a story? I've got a feeling we kind of touched on it when it originally came around, didn't we?
We covered it when it was announced, but we didn't cover, like, the fallout afterwards. But
yeah. Maybe on the patrons bit we did.
Yes. Yeah. So
I don't think we tend to cover fallouts of this kind.
Yeah,
of stuff
we don't tend to cover the negative too much, do we?
We're not a drama podcast. We've always said that, but I think this story is maybe worth covering for just kind of interest, maybe, or maybe to kind of just make some people aware of it. Because obviously, if you want to read more into it, our mate Slopes, he did a great series of videos all about this. Actually interviewed the guy as well, and I think had a bit of trouble with him, didn't he, last year? This was a project that we did talk about when it first got announced. I remember we were quite skeptical about it. This was a product called the Super Sega that was promoted as kind of being a console that played basically all of Sega's main consoles all in one, wasn't it? It was like meant to be a Saturn, a Dreamcast, a Master System, a Mega Drive, kind of that would play all those games.
Yeah.
And we looked at it and we thought, okay, how's that going to work then? Turned out, our mate Slopes did a big investigation into this. The project kind of crashed and burned. There were some kind of quite dodgy prototypes that came along.
I think
legal threats from Sega.
Load of money that went missing as well, which is pretty awful if people have put it down, you know.
I mean, I must admit, it was one of those kind of, we don't ever like to poo-poo anything in its early stages, but it did. It was one of those. It definitely did seem kind of, if it's too good to be true, then it probably isn't true.
We don't like to poo-poo things, but this next story.
Yeah, let's poo-poo this. Now, well, it turns out that the guy behind this is Alejandro Martin, who's quite a character. If you watch the video Slopes did, that I'll link in the show notes when I check him out. Because he did a few interviews with him, didn't he? And I think Ian Lee did a couple of videos with him as well that were quite bizarre to watch. But it turns out after the failure of the Super Sega project, Alejandro's back with something new. This time maybe slightly less ambitious than an all-in-one Sega console. He's making wooden PC cases.
I like the look of these.
I was thinking the same.
And also from this time extension article, they like the look of it, but I think because of who it's coming from, they've said they've not reached for their wallets so quickly.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's put out a video basically showing it off.
It looks like LGR's dream computer tower case.
Yeah, it's it's weird because it's a wooden computer tower case, but it looks very modern. And the finish on it and everything is quite nice. I do quite like the look of it. It's just who it's by. So it's very much
the history.
Yeah. Will it happen? And if it does happen, will you actually receive one if you buy one? Basically, is my question behind it.
And I think with the history of the Sega, the Super Sega project that he worked on, I think, a healthy amount of skepticism. Mm-hmm. It's probably warranted in this case.
It's an interesting concept. Yeah. I'm sure he's not the first person to have done this.
No.
Wooden cases. I remember people have done modified stuff for years. I built a Lego case years ago. The thing about this is it's like the craftsmanship has to be really high level and also the right wood, Once you get into the world of wood, it's a whole different world, looking at the video, it looks all right. Yeah, it looks like he's doing a kind of standard job on the prototype case. It's all right. It's not groundbreaking or anything. I just think it's probably hit the news because it's come from this bloke. I'd like to see is I'd like to see recycled wood. Someone build one out of like an old pallet or something. That would be pretty cool. Like, try and make it look pallet. Really nice.
I could just imagine coming around to your house and you've just got a makeshift pallet with a normal computer tower in the middle of it. Yeah. My wooden computer tower. A
couple of hard drives screwed into it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love a bit of innovation with stuff like this and a bit of, mad stuff. But,
I remember,
build your own. It's pretty easy to do.
Well, obviously, back in the 70s, kind of, wooden kind of appliances were all the rage, weren't they? I remember when I was a kid, my nana still had a wooden kind of TV, with wood around it, wood kind of paneling on it.
Yeah.
And like wooden hi-fis and stuff as well. So it does kind of feel like it's been a good 40 years since that was kind of in vogue. Maybe it is kind of due a comeback, these kind of wooden looks on
things. It depends if it's done correctly, If your PC gets hot and it's on a piece of wood, I don't know.
I hope it's got some good fireproofing on it.
Yeah. Oh, I love that burning maple smell in my living room. Yeah,
nice log fire. No, that's my PC. But yeah, I mean, I'm not suggesting that these products are going to do that. This is a website called CompuWood.com if you want to check out the designs. I've got to say, like you said, Joe, I think, you know, looking at the mock-ups, it does actually look quite well done. I think, you know, visually, it's quite aesthetically pleasing.
And most of them are render, so probably.
It's hard to tell. I mean, renders are getting pretty good these days. But I think, you know, it does seem a much simpler thing to do than building a console that can play all the Sega things. So maybe this is something that will happen. But obviously, with the track record, use your own discretion. So, interesting to see that Alejandro is back, though. So if you want to read more about that, I'll link that in the show notes. Now, let's finish off with a Sega story, actually, and one that's raised a few eyebrows over the last week or so. And it is kind of getting to the stage now where, and some people have commented on this, kind of feels like, are we scraping the barrel a little bit in terms of looking for things to remake? Because I don't know who wanted this. This is apparently one of the worst regarded RPGs on the Mega Drive that's making a comeback on modern consoles. Now, I hope I'm pronouncing this right. Is it Tracia?
Yeah, I think it's Tracia. Which it never came out in the UK. Only came out in Japan and on the Genesis in America, North America. Came out in 1991. Basically was very poorly reviewed at the time. Scored 5 out of 10 from Beep and 13 out of 40 in Famitsu, the Japanese magazine. Basically got compared to other Sega Mega Drive RPGs such as Shining in Darkness and Shining Force. That might have been
Phantasy Star games as
Phantasy
well.
Phantasy Star, yeah. Basically, there's much better RPGs out there.
And it never felt to me like the Mega Drive wasn't like flush with RPGs like the SNES was, but it did have a few gems.
It's got a few, and they're fan favourites, you know. People do, in the few that they've got, many of those few are highly regarded, but not Tracia. And this is a story that I missed in 2025, so last year. The game was re-released with physical cartridge with a enhanced English translation as well as a Spanish translation of the game. And it was released by a company called Shinyuden and Ratalakaya Games. I think is how you say it, Ratalakaya Games. So they released a physical re-release of this game last year, which we didn't cover. I didn't see that. But they've now announced that it's coming to PS5, PS4, Xbox, Switch, and PC. On the day of release of this episode, April 24th, 2026. But it does just feel a little bit like you say, like, is it just we're running out of games to keep re-releasing? Like, I feel...
Like, who's asking for this?
Who's asking for this? But I feel like there's so many other games that you could have re-released for the Mega Drive. Like, you know, maybe not many RPG games to re-release, or maybe there's somebody... The owner of this company, the CEO of this company, was a big fan of this game growing up or something. I don't know. But it feels a bit strange. Like, I get it releasing it now on modern console because they already released it physically, like for Sega Mega Drive a year ago. So I understand that. Like, they have the license, they released it physically. So let's now just put it out there for other people to play it for probably £10 or something. But I don't get why they did it in the first place, if that makes sense. But there must have been some sort of market for it. It must have sold. And interestingly, it was also on Evercade in 2022.
Yeah, all the rights like landed on them. And they were just like, right, let's just do this and release it and see.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe they're just like, we've got it. Let's just release it 3 times. Yeah, Evercade in 2022. Physical release again in 2025. Mm. And now a digital release. For modern systems, for a game that was, from what I understand, not very well known and poorly reviewed.
It's interesting though, because looking at this article that I'll link on in the Show Notes from Time extension, they say it was apparently reviewed, an import copy of it, by the UK magazine Sega Pro mm-hmm. in 1993. And one of their major criticisms was not only the lack in gameplay, but the graphics as well. But now, there is some screenshots yeah. in this article. I mean, I'm not a massive RPG fan, as you guys know. I think it actually looks all right for a Mega Drive RPG graphically. Mm. Am I being a bit kind of too generous there?
If you follow that article, it gives you a list of... I think you're being a bit generous. If you follow that article, there's a list of time extensions, top 10 RPGs for the Sega Mega Drive. And just look at those games. They're so colourful, so bright yeah. and colourful, whereas this game just looks a bit brown and muddy and washed out. I mean, I know it's an action-adventure game, but one of my favourite games in the Mega Drive is Story of Four. And that game is a beautiful-looking game for the Sega Mega Drive. You know, it's well, I mean, that game came out in like 94, 95. So, yes, it was a few years later. But yeah, apparently, I think so much better on the console.
There's some new features with this version. So, there's the rewind function as well. So, you can repeat
on an RPG. Interesting.
Yeah. There's also cheats function. So, you can activate all the cheats at any time, listen to the music, whichever track you want. And
if you don't want to play the game, you can skip it all, in other words. Yeah,
yeah. There's also like retro style monitor stuff, and you can run it in black and white as well, interestingly.
Yeah, I think in terms of maybe, you know, historical curiosity pieces, I mean, it might have some appeal there, if maybe. Because I think there is definitely a thing to be said about kind of playing famously bad games. But this doesn't seem like it's a game that is that bad. It will kind of make those lists.
Yeah, I don't think it's famous enough or bad enough for it to have that like kind of like cult following.
Yeah, just somewhere in the middle. But yeah, I mean, if it's like, you know, only a couple of quid on Steam, then might be worth a look in, but you can wishlist it now if you are at all curious. Okay, then a little reminder that we have a Patreon that supports this podcast. We give a load back to our patrons as well. We actually do a massive meeting at the end of every month, one of those coming up this coming Sunday. We do it at 8 p.m. UK time, and this is where we basically send a link out to all our patrons. It is it's a Google Meets call, isn't it? So we say anyone can come on, bit of a virtual users group, show off your collections, talk about new pickups you got recently, get advice, really friendly community. And we invite all patrons along to that. So if you'd like to join us for this weekend's Patrons Hangout, that's going to be happening on Sunday night. Also, we do the After Hours podcast, which is for gold members and above. So if you want a little bonus podcast that we put out most months for our patrons, you can unlock that as well. You get an ad-free episode of the normal podcast, and we do a few extra news stories every week as well. So the main reason, though, is just to help us out and helps all the running costs of doing the podcast every week. So if you want to join the patrons community, all the details are at theretrohour.com. All right, well, thank you so much for checking out the news this week. Of course, we'll have more for you next Friday. And next, going inside the world of Atari, Sinclair, and lots more with our special guest, John Matheson. He's next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're with the Retro Hour podcast, and it's time to welcome on this week's very special guest. Now, today, our guest has designed some of the most ambitious and legendary hardware in the gaming industry. Not all of it made it out the door as well. Now, I'm very pleased to talk to him because if you are a regular listener, you know that I am a fan of the Atari Jaguar. I thought it was a system that was, you know, hardware-wise, quite ahead of its time and not really utilised to the full extent. And also, some systems that you might not be familiar with that our guest this week worked on, including his start at Sinclair Research, working on the ZX Spectrum. Of course, legendary machine, and then working on a system they were working on called the Loki, but didn't make it out the door. Then went on to found Flare Technology, working on the Konix multi-system, and then that partnership with Atari Corporation, working on the Jaguar and the Panther, and then a system called the Nuon as well that was a really interesting system that we'll definitely explore a bit more. So we thought we'd get out the story of what happened behind the scenes and building those machines as well. So let's welcome on our special guest this week, John Matheson. How's it going, John?
That's good. Yeah, good to meet you.
Yeah, appreciate you taking some time to reminisce about those exciting times in the 80s and 90s with us. I mean, one thing I always like to kind of do when we get a guest on is to kind of wind it right back to the beginning of your story then. I mean, do you kind of remember what first got you into electronics? I mean, like, you know, going right back to when you were a kid, were you the kind of kid that had build things and take apart, you know, appliances around the house? What kind of got you into it all?
Yeah, I was. I used to pull things apart to see how they worked. I was into model railways for a while as a kid and used to play with the electrics on those a lot. Got into starting messing around with electrical wiring. My parents somehow never caught me doing that. So, I found that interesting. I went to college in Cambridge and started off doing fairly general engineering. Realized that the electrical part of that and the electronic part of that was most interesting to me. So I switched to computer science.
I think that's really interesting because Cambridge is obviously a center for computing. And, you know, what were the departments like and, you know, the facilities back then?
Well, at that point, the computing was very much still mainframe based. University had an IBM 360 and we used to go to the terminals and taught ourselves the early form of hacking where you set up a dummy login screen and left it to capture the guy that follows your password and stupid stuff like that. There were some very rudimentary games on it we'd play. There was a Star Trek game that involved little characters on the screen. And I think it was an adventure game of some sort, some form.
Well, obviously the personal computer revolution was, you know, starting in the late 70s. I mean, do you kind of remember the first computer you got at home then? And did you learn programming on it? What was kind of the story of your journey into personal computing?
The computer science at that time was really still taught entirely on the mainframes. We really didn't have personal computers in the Cambridge Computer Lab at that point. So the first time I ever came across a whole computer was the ZX81. When I started at St. Clair, Clive gave me one. He said, go home and play with this. And of course, he gave it to one of the... That time, you could buy the complete computer or a kit. He gave me the kit. So the first thing I had to do was solder it all together, which I guess is a test of its own.
Yeah, right in the deep end.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, tell us about how you got to St. Clair then. Because, I mean, obviously, you're at Cambridge. St. Clair was based in Cambridge as well. How did you get the job? And do you remember the interview then? What kind of happened there?
Yeah, well, I met a girl in the pub. That was the short version of the story. I first couple of months after I left college, there were three of us who'd all graduated at the same time. We'd spent the summer goofing around, then started seriously looking for a job. I was interviewing at various places. I forget. There were a couple of big electronics companies. I think Plessy was one of them in Cambridge at the time. But one night, I had some friends who played in the band. We met some girls in the pub. We ended up going back to one of them's house. She ended up going out with one of the band guys. But her dad came in and he was like chatting to us and said, well, what do you do? And so I explained. He said, oh, you should come meet Clive Sinclair. It turns out he was a recruiter. So he introduced me to Clive. Clive said, okay, come in and see me. And he said, okay, I'll test you out. Like, write me reports on the hand computer industry. Come back in a week with it. So I went off and did that. And I'm sure it was very naive and stupid because what did I know? But he liked it enough. He hired me. So my first job at that point, the Spectrum was well advanced in its development. Mm-hmm. So my job was to sit and test the basic interpreter. So I'd sat at what they had this was before we had the for anti-chips for it back. So it was a big breadboard, you know, 2 foot by 2 foot square with lots of chips running Spectrum basic.
That must have been fantastic, you know, just meeting Clive and kind of getting in with such an iconic figure in the computer industry so quickly.
Yeah, it really was. And Clive was a great boss. He was his biggest weakness was as soon as something was in production, he lost interest in it and was on to the next thing. Mm. So Sinclair really didn't have much focus on being good at production. Which we all know what happened to the Spectrum, but it was a really fun place to work. He hired a lot of very smart people, encouraged them to, you know, work together and do the best work. And then he'd two or three times a week we'd all go out to the pub in the evening, and Clive would pick up the tab. He was kind of reaching the peak of his fame at that point before the whole C5 thing, I think, tarnished his reputation. So he was just a obviously a very wealthy guy, and certainly from perspective of a 22-year-old college graduate. He was had a very nice house that he'd invite us all to from time to time. He put on a big fireworks party every year. He was actually great buddies with the Microman thing had him in this great rivalry with Chris Curry. But yeah. In actual fact, they were great buddies. They didn't always see eye to eye on things. But, you know, I think the stories of them fighting were somewhat overblown. I've certainly had a beer with the two of them many times.
I find it really interesting that, you know, the Spectrum was released when a recession was going on, and, you know, there was a lot of cost-cutting stuff. I just wondered how the decisions were kind of made on, you know, how this machine would be kind of capable, what the limitations were, and also, did you see any, like, prototypes of other machines at the time?
Well, I think Clive's goal was always to do electronics at very low cost. I mean, the Sinclair Radionics business that existed before Sinclair Research was doing very cheap hi-fis. I think he had the vision to see the home computers coming. The ZX80 was, you know, extremely bare-bones computer. The ZX81 fixed a lot of problems with that. You know, it didn't flicker quite as much. It was a more complete system. And the Spectrum was really, the goal was to take that to the next step, but keep the low-cost basis. So it was all very much about doing things cheaply.
Well, you mentioned that you're working on the BASIC on the Spectrum, testing that. I mean, do you remember any kind of bugs or quirks in the Spectrum that, like, really stuck with you, or any challenges that you and the team had to kind of overcome with that?
I mean, these were the days before software engineering was really done very formally. So, no, my job was just sit and write programs and see if they did what I expected them to do. I mean, I was actually kind of proud of it, because really the only significant bug, I think, there was if you did into -65536, it gave you the wrong answer. But that was about the only significant bug in Spectrum BASIC. It was just trying everything out, you know. Pick each of the commands, write little for loops to make them do various things. At the same time, I got tasked with writing a demo program for the launch.
Yeah, tell us about the launch. What do you remember about the launch of the Spectrum? Was that a big deal?
It seemed to be at the time, yeah. Where did we launch the Spectrum? Somewhere in London. I don't even remember where now. But somehow the QL launch sticks in my mind more than the Spectrum launch. But I do remember going to a lot of the early computer shows with it, Personal Computer World in London. And it was always amazing. Kids would come up, walk up to one of the computers and stand there and type for half an hour. And at the end of it, they typed in a game. It was amazing what people were capable of.
It was interesting as well because, of course, we had that phrase, Jet Set Effing Willy.
You know, Clive
kind of had the you know, the attitude that he wanted to make a serious machine, and that was the same with the QL. Was there kind of a focus more on the serious side of it over gaming?
Yeah, I mean, the initial games we did for the system were all pretty simplistic. This whole, well, at the time where advanced games happened, I think significantly after the launch. I mean, we had Reversi and chess and I forget what else, but it was more sort of lightweight educational hands-on games than the market that emerged later. And the Spectrum wasn't really intended to be a gaming machine.
Yeah, just it was affordable and had graphical capabilities. So
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it had just enough.
Well, how did you go from like the software side of it into more like a hardware and systems engineering role at Sinclair then? What was kind of your development there after the Spectrum was released?
I think because the Spectrum, I was so deeply involved with the Spectrum, everyone else kind of moved on to the next thing, which was the QL. So I kind of ended up running Spectrum engineering. We did a lot of, they said, okay, you could go make it more manufacturable. So we relayed out the main circuit board several times. We moved the heat sinks around. We did a bunch of things to stop some of the reliability problems with the early Spectrums, with limited resources, but I think we made it a lot more manufacturable over the course of the next 3 or 4 years. And that's really where I cut my teeth, learning manufacturing, learning hardware design.
What were some of those issues that you kind of ironed out then?
Well, the original Spectrum board had a number of things that required tuning on the production line. I don't know how much you remember about the inspections. One of the problems was that there were some little variable capacitor adjustments for the crystals that provided the reference frequency for the color on the color TV, and those would drift over time. And so suddenly people would send them back because the picture had gone black and white. So I remember spending half of the, we had a great relationship with a local TV shop in Cambridge because we bought so many TVs from them. So they let me go in with a prototype Spectrum and test it on every TV in the shop. Mm. And what we were trying to do was work out what the tolerance, you know, because the PAL TV standard said the frequency for the color data has to be within 1 hertz, which was impossibly accurate. But in reality, TVs were much more tolerant than that. So we just did some field testing and worked out what we could get away with, and then just specified a crystal that didn't need tuning that was in that band.
Mm. I love that. You know, modern companies have rooms full of official testers and monitors, and you just like go to the local TV shop and use them all. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the probably one of Sinclair's most mythical projects, the Loki. Now, I've read so many different things about this online that originally it was a games console. Another report said it was a computer that was intended to basically be a rival to the Amiga. What's the truth behind that then? What's kind of the background of Loki? What was it?
Well, Loki was really just a proposal. We never built anything. Loki was as much as anything, just an idea. The idea was that hey, there is this market for gaming with home computers. What if we could do something like a Spectrum all over again? How could we make it a bit better at gaming? And yeah, there was, I think by that time we'd seen enough specs of the Amiga to realize that, you know, they'd very much gone for that market. But in some ways, the Amiga's architecture was inefficient. It had multiple ways of doing the same thing. It had a sprite engine, then it also had a blitter. You know, those two engines kind of do the same sort of thing. They make things move around the screen. So we thought in a simpler way, well, we could do it with just one of those.
And was it going to be a console then? What was the aim of it?
I don't think we ever quite got that far. I mean, there may have been some industrial design doodlings around it, but I don't think it had advanced to the point that Clive had adopted it as a product.
Right, exactly. I heard there was some other kind of projects that came before that, like the Super Spectrum. I remember hearing about that, and something called the LC3. That was a games console apparently that was in the works as well. I mean, any kind of memories of those, or was that just kind of the magazines starting rumors?
Well, there was a project I worked on called Pandora, and Pandora was essentially a combination of the Spectrum with the flat screen TV. Mm. You remember, I think they had the little black and white TV with the bizarre picture tube where you kind of shot the electron beam in from the side. And it was like something out of a Terry Pratchett film. He was essentially putting a Fresnel lens, a magnifying glass on the front of that screen to act as the monitor. And this was going to be a portable computer.
That's ahead of its time.
LC3, but that was low-cost color computer. I don't remember the I don't remember what it stands for. I do not remember the context of that.
Were they that just
even,
again like...
Is that even a Sinclair thing?
Yeah, it's on the Loki page on Wikipedia. Yeah, it mentions the LC3 games console that was cancelled apparently in 1983. But I mean, where they get their information from to make the pages? I think I've read like, rumors over the years. So
yeah, I think it's one of these things that was discussed but wasn't ever a reality.
Yeah. Well, tell us about when Alan Sugar came in. Then I mean. Do you remember kind of what the vibe was when Sinclair was acquired by Amstrad? What are your memories of that?
Well, Sinclair collapsed. I mean, Sinclair was heading into bankruptcy. And this was just Clive looking to sell the business and get out. So he had Sinclair Research, where he had a bunch of pet projects going on. There was a project to do... Again, way ahead of his time as usual, there's a project doing wafer scale integration, which is building a computer around an entire wafer rather than breaking into chips. I don't remember what else was going on there. There was a bunch of crazy stuff going on. And Clive wanted to keep that going. So he sold the computer business to Amstrad basically to avoid bankruptcy, laid off 90% of the staff. Sadly, Martin Brennan and myself, Clive liked us too much. He kept us on. So we spent a week trying to get laid off.
No redundancy pay, yeah.
and then we had to resign. Yeah, we didn't get any redundancy. So, I mean, it was a very sad time because, we'd formed a great team over the years and it all just abruptly ended one day.
I was wondering, you must have seen a lot of C5s in your time as well, kind of being around that area.
Yeah, well, we had a few in the office. Yeah, I mean, I wrote, we had an office out in Milton, which is where most of the engineering moved to. And I remember riding one from there into Cambridge one day, and halfway in, the nylon gearbox fell apart, as they were prone to, and I had to pedal it the rest of the way. But they were fun when they worked.
Again, that's another kind of innovation of Clive. I mean, you know, electric vehicles are a big business now, but I guess, you know, obviously there was the kind of the quality control issues, you could say. But I think in terms of the idea, though, it was probably just a couple of decades early with it.
Yeah, I mean, in so many ways, what Clive was doing was a great idea. It's just ahead of his time, which you have to admire him for. He did that so many times.
Well, you mentioned that you and Martin didn't get your redundancy. So what was kind of the story with you both leaving Sinclair and then forming your own company, Flare? What was kind of the thinking behind the move then?
Well, we saw what was coming before it happened. We were toying with the idea of starting a company to do it all again ourselves and to build something out of the ashes of Loki, if you like. I mean, there was we didn't take any design work. We took a concept with us. And Flare, what Martin, Ben Cheese, and myself founded Flare One with the goal of doing our version of a home computer, really an answer to Amiga, but much lower cost. And that was what we set out to do with Flare One. We had a relationship with a local company called Qdos, who did essentially custom chips on an electron beam machine where they can make them one at a time. So we prototyped it with that, and we built the Flare One system. And as you probably know, that's what turned into the Koenigs multi-system.
Yeah, so kind of talk us through the architecture of Flare One then. I mean, what kind of made it different to other machines at the time? It sounds like, you know, if you're kind of going for that kind of, you know, almost Amiga-level performance, it must have been quite capable.
Yeah, we had a couple of hardware engines we designed for it. One was the Blitter, which was, you know, it's a 2D graphics engine, could draw lines, could do flood fills, things like that. It was a graphics accelerator. And the other was we had a DSP in there for audio.
So before Koenigs came onto the scene then, I mean, how kind of far along did the Flare One prototype actually get? And what kind of demos were you running on it? Do you remember?
We had a demo program running for it. We were talking to a bunch of people. We didn't get all that much traction with it. We did sell it to a company called Bell Fruit, who used it to make pub quiz machines. But we had a demo. We had things like we did some very crude video capture of a scene from the Blues Brothers. You know, by taking a VCR, pausing it, we were able to do a screen capture very slowly, then advancing it one frame, capturing the next frame, taking it down to 256 colors in the most intelligent way we could, so we could actually play a little short video clip. We had, because it's the Blitter could do like flood fills, we had a 3D cube rotating, which was kind of an answer to some stuff Amiga did, like the bouncing ball demo. We had it was just a wireframe 3D cube, and it would draw the lines to the wireframe and then let it flood fill the sides. But it looked like 3D, even though it really wasn't. I forget what else, but we had a bunch of graphics demos.
How did the deal with Koenigs come about then? And what were they kind of asking you to deliver? And what did you think of the idea of the Koenigs multi-system? Because for our listeners who might not know, it was a kind of all-in-one gaming system that had lots of accessories as well. You could kind of switch it and change it into what you required.
Yeah, well, the Koenigs multi-system was the brainchild of a guy called Win Holloway, who Koenigs at that time had an active business building joysticks and steering wheel controllers and things like that. And he saw a logical extension of that. It's just building a computer around these accessories. So the goal of the Koenigs multi-system was to, it had like a basic framework, and you could attach joysticks and steering wheels and stuff like that. And then he also had which was great for press coverage, was a chair, which was a motorized chair you could sit in and play the Koenigs multi-system.
Did you ever have a go in the chair yourself?
Yeah, I would say sat in our office for a couple of months at one point because he didn't have anywhere else to store it. Yeah, it was crude. It was I think there was only ever one of them.
And you guys were kind of providing the background and the hardware for that then?
Yeah, so we our goal was to create a custom chip. We took the four chips that were the Flare One system, combined them into one. We changed the CPU from a Z80 to an 8086 to get a bit more performance out of it. But yeah, we taped out that chip. You know, it was ready to go to production. We had active games in development.
I saw the Last Ninja was one that was quite impressive as well.
But he ran out of money before he could get it into production.
I was going to ask kind of when you realized it went wrong then. I mean, did you think it was too ambitious, or do you kind of what happened from your perspective with it then? Because I remember there was TV adverts running for it, wasn't there, and stuff. It was probably quite close, I imagine.
Yeah, it was frustratingly close.
Yeah.
I don't think we had much insight into Koenig's business side. I don't know what his plans were to raise money to get it into production and what fell through. But yeah, in the end, he couldn't get the funding to take it into production.
I know Jeff Minter was one of the developers on it, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. What was it like working with Jeff on it?
Oh, Jeff's a great guy. I love Jeff. He just comes out of left field. He's happy to program in assembly language. He'll take a look at a piece of hardware and work out a way to misuse it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he said we interviewed him at Play Expo in Blackpool. I think he said he's got one of the very few prototypes still of the multi-system. So,
and does he? Oh, good for him.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. I guess you haven't got any in your attic then, John. There's none lurking around.
I do not.
Yeah.
When a project ends ugly like that, it's often not a good idea to hang on to things just in case.
Well, I mean, you make a good point there that, you know, it did have an ugly ending. I mean, how did that affect Flare at the time? Because obviously Atari came along. What was kind of that intermediate period like between?
Well, we ran a little consulting business as part of Flare. That was kind of how we paid the wages. We actually did some work for Alan Sugar. We designed a hard disk controller for his PCs. And we did a couple of other things like that. It was actually an interesting story of how we came to meet Alan Sugar, because we'd seen him with Clive when the Sinclair thing folded up, but I hadn't really met the guy. But one of the first things that happened after when we started Flare One and hunting around for ways to make money was we were approached by the Spanish importer of Spectrums, a company called Investronica, and they had done a Spanish translation of the Spectrum ROM. And somehow out of that, they ended up owning the copyright for it, which put them in a very unique position to build a Spectrum clone, because really the most protectable thing was the copyright on the ROM contents.
Mm.
So we designed a Spectrum compatible for them, because we knew it very well. We did it in about 4 weeks. Build a custom chip for them, and they took that into production, which obviously upset Alan Sugar no end. So he sent us a very strong letter from his London lawyers. So we did what the only sensible thing to do in the circumstances, which is to go out and hire some very expensive London lawyers ourselves that we could barely afford. Uh-huh. And we ended up in a conference room somewhere in the east of London, neutral territory, hammering out a settlement, and we essentially ended up promising not to do it again, and he agreed to give us some work.
Wow. So it turned out good in the end. You got on his radar.
It turned out very well, yes.
You're glad that you hired those lawyers, I can imagine. Yeah. So when the relationship with Atari began, what was it like? And was it like, the legendary Atari, and you start working with them, and had you got a lot of like respect and knowledge of the company?
Well, a buddy of ours, a guy called Richard Miller, had actually moved to the States to work for Atari. He worked as he was actually an employee of Sinclair, but he was a contractor for a few months, did a floppy disk interface for the QL, I think. And, you know, we'd become friends. So he said, if you guys are looking for some work, Atari would be happy to give you some. So the first thing we did, which Martin Brennan really led, was worked on a project called Panther, which was another 2D graphics gaming engine, really based around an extremely flexible sprite engine. But at the same time, we were talking about, well, what could we do with Flare 2, which was, at this point, Ben Chu's left us. He went to go off and do his own thing. So Martin and I said, let's do it again. So we had this notion that 3D was obviously coming, so we pitched that to Atari. And they said, yes, we'd love you to develop this for us. You know, we'll pay you so much a month to cover your costs. And, you know, you give us regular status updates. It was a nice, flexible agreement. They left us alone to get on with it. So we started working on what became Jaguar. And in the end, that progressed so well that Atari abandoned Panther and decided to go straight for Jaguar.
Yeah, cause I remember hearing that the Panther was, again, another system like the Konix Multisystem that was really far along in development. I know there's some prototypes out there. So, I mean, was there anything of that you kind of carried forward, or was that system just totally abandoned then?
So the display engine that we used in Jaguar was very much based on the Panther one. So I don't know how much you know about the Jaguar architecture, but the display controller works through a linked list of pixel buffer commands and composites them in a line buffer within the chip. And that was very similar. But that was essentially the graphics engine of Panther. So that covered 2D graphics. Then the other thing we did was to extend the Blitter that we'd done in Flare 1 to do 3D graphics. So we developed a new RISC engine for that to do the higher levels of 3D graphics. And then the Blitter essentially became what a modern GPU would be called a raster op. And it could do, you could give it a start and end point, and it would do, it could linearly interpolate a Z value and use that to do Z buffering, to do clipping. And it could linearly interpolate an intensity value, so it could do shading, Gura shading.
So, I mean, today that's, you know, the architecture of the Jaguar, I guess, in many ways, is similar to consoles that came after it with the multiple processors kind of approach. But did developers kind of struggle with it a little bit then? Because I know I've heard a lot of stories about, you know, we've had them on this podcast, developers who found the system tough to program for, whether that was Atari's lack of documentation or just them struggling with the architecture. What do you think from your perspective?
I think that was still an era in which we were very limited on what we can put in silicon. And yes, it's a fair criticism to say it was not easy to program. You've got anything that involves multiple non-symmetrical processors is inherently difficult. I think also nobody had ever tried to create 3D games before, and nobody realized how hard that is, especially without the tool chains that you have today.
And to your point earlier about Jeff Minter being able to, you know, pick up anything and kind of go with it, he really shone on that system, actually. And some of the stuff that he did was, you know, some of the best stuff that we saw on the Jaguar.
Yeah, I mean Jeff was supremely happy getting deep in the weeds of how the hardware worked. You know, the 3D graphics stuff we had in the Blitter, he completely misused it. There was some rudimentary support for texture mapping that could do linear interpolation in two dimensions through a pixel buffer that was intended to be a source of repixels. He used that RISC generator to generate right pixels instead. So he could make things blow up and scatter just by using the hardware to do that. And he used that to great effect, both in the what was it? The Tempest 2K, wasn't it?
That was the one. Yeah, one of the best versions.
And the sound to light show thing.
Yeah, the virtual light machine. Yeah, on the CD. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, obviously the 68K processor was on the motherboard as well, which you know, a lot of people say that's maybe was a bit of the downfall of the Jaguar, that a lot of developers didn't utilize the full custom chips in there. They thought, well, we'll just do kind of lazy Amiga or Mega Drive ports over to it using the 68K. I mean, what role did you intend it to play in the system then? And was that kind of misused by a lot of developers, do you think?
I think all the better games used the hardware. It was just hard to do. Yeah, I mean, I think there were some fairly crude ports. I mean, a 2D engine, you really didn't need to start using the GPU for 3D hardware processing. So I think some of the side-scrollers didn't make much use of it. But I think 68000 was always intended to be like the manager.
Yeah.
You know, it's running the file system. It's running the high-level game logic. It was always intended. It's a general-purpose processor. It's much easier to program. There's better tools for it. There's C compilers. We actually built a few early on with 68020s as well, which were lovely.
Oh, wow.
But that
it's
got
a bit more
down.
Expensive. Yeah.
It was way too expensive. Yeah, it was a much faster CPU there. It would have been a lovely system.
I know that the Tramiels were always known as being quite thrifty, you know, in their Commodore days as well. Jack trying to save a penny or two here and there. I mean, how did you find them to work with them? What was kind of your relationship? Did you deal much with like Sam and Jack and Leonard? What was kind of your memories of them?
at that point, Jack was fairly hands-off. He'd come into the office occasionally and yell at people. But yeah, so I worked closely. So Sam was the CEO of the company. We worked with him and we set up the business deal on it. His brother Leonard ran software. And then there was a third brother who was kind of on the sales side of Gary Schmell. They were kind of ran the company. And they had a pretty successful business with the STs. But the failure of Jaguar was based around Jack didn't believe in marketing and didn't really believe it was worth spending a lot of money to create games that the game writing would come. So we had a bit of a catch-22 with Jaguar, the classic gaming industry one where there's not enough installed base to interest game developers, and there's not enough games to for the computer to sell itself. And you can market your way out of that problem. We saw Sony, and Sony came in with the PlayStation 1. You know, they reputedly spent $500 million launching PlayStation 1.
Yeah, no one knew. So they're like, Sony make TVs and hi-fis. What the hell are they doing in gaming? That's not going to succeed. We've heard that before then. Yeah, like you said, all that marketing clout they gave it.
Right, exactly.
And I think when you saw something like Doom, you know, running really well and kind of using the hardware in the correct manner, you know, that really stood out and showed what the Jaguar could do. And I guess some other titles didn't really go down that route.
Yeah, and then again, you know, as in Jeff Minter, John Carmack is an incredible programmer. And we work very closely with him. He'd fire off questions about how a particular piece of hardware works, how fast various operations were, things like that. And I think he's the sort of guy that very much enjoys getting to grips with hardware like that and getting the most out of it.
And I think people probably underestimate kind of the technical marvel that was Doom on the Jaguar. Because, you know, before that, he needed an expensive PC to play Doom. I mean, you know, I remember famously they said an Amiga version would never come out because they couldn't handle it. And then the fact that, you know, the Jaguar version written by John Carmack is, you know, still to this day considered one of the best console ports of it. So, yeah, if you had got the system in someone who knew how to use its hands.
And Doom was written to, I mean, really Doom was written for PCs that didn't have 3D hardware. So give him some 3D acceleration, he was very happy.
I mean, in terms of the chipset and the development, you know, kind of leading up to the launch, I mean, any kind of technical challenges you remember kind of in the development or kind of bringing the silicon up?
we had a bug in, Cybermorph, the launch title. So the problem was it would run for 4 or 5 hours and then it would crash. These are the worst kinds of bugs. And we ended up, at that point we were in the UK, we ended up spending a lot of time in Sunnyvale in California with the attention to detail team trying to generate shorter versions of the piece of code that crashed. And we spent about 6 weeks tearing our hair out on that. And, you know, clearly this was a showstopper. If the pack-in game crashes every few hours, that's not a good thing. Eventually we found it. Yeah, it was a design. There's a classic chip design problem where you have a signal coming onto a chip and it gets sampled at a clock edge, and two different flip-flops sample it, and one catches a clock later than the other one, one time in 100,000.
Wow. Yeah. Bet there's some late nights during that time.
There were some late nights, yeah.
I thought it was really interesting with the Jag that, you know, kind of early in its life, the CD drive came out. And was there a kind of debate that we would start it with a CD drive? And, you know, how much do you think that CD add-on added to it and potential it had? Because I know it was kind of not selling amazingly well at that point. Yeah, I just always find that really interesting, the kind of addition of the CD-ROM.
It was very well. It was a question of timing. Yeah, I think we all would have launched with a CD-ROM if we could have. But at that time, CD-ROM drives were super expensive. I remember, you know, we had one of the early CD-ROM writers, and you had to like tiptoe out of the room when you set it to write because the slightest vibration and it would go wrong. And we really, it was just waiting for the price to come down.
That would have ramped up the price for the entire console, wouldn't it? And
it was just not turnable when we launched it back in 1993.
Well, what were some of the most impressive things you remember seeing on the Jaguar then? Were there any things that kind of stick in your mind?
The one that blew me away was a company just up the street in Sunnyvale. had one of the very, very early video codecs that they ported to Jaguar. This is before MPEG. And they had Jaguar essentially sitting there playing Jaws. And it absolutely blew my mind. Because at that point, video on a computer was, you know, you could have maybe a fit half a second in memory and that was it. The fact that you could compress it down to the point you could stream it off a CD and play it in real time was absolutely mind-blowing. It's one of those things. I mean, I'm sure you've had a moment recently when you've realized what AI can do that just blew your mind for a moment.
Yeah.
This is one of those mind-blowing moments that's, wow, this is going to change the world.
I remember seeing, you know, the quarter screen, not really full motion video, but just video running on a Sega Mega CD or a Commodore CD TV in Comet and being blown away by that. But yeah, I think
it's like quarter of a screen. It was probably quarter VGA or something.
Yeah. Just, you weren't used to seeing real people on a video game system, were you?
Real video was just mind blowing. Yeah.
It was interesting as well because yet another project that Jeff Minter worked on was the new one. You guys also kind of seem to follow, and I find that really amazing that it was kind of built, a games console built into a DVD player, and this whole kind of new concept of gaming in your living room as well. What was the transition like from Atari to new one?
Well, Atari went bust. Bit of a track record of companies going bust on me. So Richard Miller, who was the guy who'd worked at Sinclair, who got us involved with Atari in the first place and was VP of engineering there, left a few months before I left Atari, and he went off and started this company called VM Labs. And, you know, we realized Atari wasn't the last. The Trammells were kind of winding it down. And so I was looking around for a job, and we actually had a fellow who'd been did all the internet connection stuff for the Atari building in the early days of internet. And he said, oh, I'm also consulting with this little firm doing 3D graphics chip. You should come along and interview with them. I said, you know, there's 35 3D graphics startups in the Valley. Are you mad? And of course, the company was NVIDIA. So I lost my chance to be a very early member of NVIDIA. So I went and joined Richard, who was at that point, I was the fourth employee at VM Labs. And yeah, the goal was to create a media processor and essentially move as much of a DVD player as we could into software and then be able to reuse that media processing for other tasks.
Was gaming kind of always one of the core ideas behind
the
new one then?
100%, yeah.
So, I mean, it always reminded me a little bit of kind of what Trip Hawkins was trying to do at 3DO, kind of this standard platform that would live in your living room. It kind of felt a bit like that, like everyone would have this kind of base platform that you know, everyone could run the same games and systems.
We had three of the 3DO hardware team at VM Labs as well. We used to make insulting comments at each other's architecture from time to time, because obviously they'd pull Jaguar to bits and we'd pull the 3DO machine to bits. So.
It's interesting as well, because just like the way it works, later on I do remember the DVD menus being a huge thing and getting massively interactive, and I was thinking, why can't I do something more on this? It's quite a limited run with the new one as well. What kind of happened there, and do you remember when it came out?
Well, we got it into production. We had it in production with Toshiba and with Samsung. And they were shipping DVD players. We had a modest amount of software for it. We had a team based out of Hollywood that was trying to put custom content on the movies. And we had a few movies with no one specific content on them. And it was starting to build some momentum. And then this was the era of the dot-com bust and 9/11. We weren't a profitable company at that point. We really needed to do one more funding round. But with the combination of the dot-com bust and then 9/11, funding dried up.
It was a shame, because I thought the idea definitely had potential.
Yeah, and it had momentum. I mean, this was a real thing, shipping in modest volume, clearly with some more content, could have got over the Catch-22 situation, because it was in volume production. And we were talking to set... set-top box companies about building set-top boxes around it. And I think it could have been something with another funding round. It was just bad timing.
They're incredibly rare to get at the moment. You know, you're looking on eBay and stuff and the prices are horrific. But I always have that dream that one day I'm going to, you know, just pick up a random DVD player and see that new one logo on there and be like, oh, wow. Yeah, do you still have one? Yeah.
No, I don't. I'm not very good at keeping things like this.
No. So I do know, I did hear that, you know, when you were still working on the Jaguar, there were plans for kind of a follow-up system that was maybe in the works at the time with stuff like the VR system as well. And kind of did hear there was like a meant to be like a Jaguar 2. I mean, kind of how much of that did you kind of carry on to New One then? Was it kind of a spiritual successor to Jaguar then in kind of your mind and architecturally?
No, architecturally it's very different.
Right.
And you know, the Tramels have a reputation for being somewhat trigger happy with lawyers. So, you know, we quite clearly made sure it was nothing like Jaguar. Mm. But there's a lot of useful experience in Jaguar. I mean, you take along your knowledge. But no, it's a fundamentally different design. I mean, the Neon was based on having this array of four VLAW CPUs doing all the heavy lifting.
And what about getting developers on board then? Because I know you talk about Jeff Minter, probably the game that everyone talks about from Neon's kind of small library. I think it only had like 8 games released on it in its run, but this Tempest 3000 was the game that Jeff made for it.
Well, yeah, we were good buddies with Jeff by then. Mm. He was on the payroll. He worked for BM Labs. You know, half the time in Wales, but he'd come over for a few weeks, sometimes a year. He actually lived in the US for, maybe almost a year. I don't remember exactly how long, but so he was very closely involved with it.
Yeah, I think the only time I played a new one was when he had a setup at a Play Expo in Blackpool, and he had a rotary controller hooked up to the new one, so you could play Tempest 3000 on that, which was definitely an experience. So, yeah. So I mean, obviously, you mentioned about the dot-com crash and 9/11, which, you know, really difficult time, not only, you know, in the tech industry, but in the world in general. I mean, so when new one kind of went away then, I mean, you mentioned that you almost got a chance to work at NVIDIA before that, but you did actually move there, didn't you, after that? So what's kind of the story there?
Well, we'd had an intern working for us at BM Labs who we did our first round of layoffs about 9 months before the final implosion. And he was one of the guys that got laid off at that point, and he went off to work for NVIDIA. And, you know, we kind of kept in touch, and he said, you know, you should come over for an interview here. So at this point, it was late 2001. The Silicon Valley was going through one of its occasional severe down cycles. You know, there was no traffic on the freeways. It's unbelievable. Mm. A very scary time in many ways. So I saw NVIDIA as a safe place to be, at least for a few years, until the economy recovered.
Well, a company that didn't go bust. I think they're doing all right at the moment, aren't they?
They're not the best. Although Jensen would always say back then, we're 90 days from going out of business.
Right. Yeah, I think they're doing okay at the minute, aren't they? So.
Yeah, it's certainly more than 90 days right now.
Yeah. Well, John, it's been great to hear some of your memories. I mean, do you kind of, obviously when I emailed you, I showed you a picture of my Jaguar setup that I can see from here. I mean, kind of looking back on what you did then, and I mean, are you aware of kind of the community around the Jaguar now and the homebrew games? I mean, there's also like Jag Fests, you know, events that people go to, and, you know, the amount of new titles we talk about in the podcast, that, you know, homebrew titles that are coming out. And I mean, does it make you feel a bit kind of, you know, vindicated almost, so that people are still embracing this machine 3 decades later?
It does. It's weird. Yeah. A couple of years ago, a guy in Poland reached out to me. Well, there's a big group of Jaguar enthusiasts, and they have an annual meeting where they all get together and drink Polish vodka, I'm sure. I did a video for them, been interviewed by various people.
Well, it's fantastic to hear some of the stories about the development, John. So, yeah, really appreciate you taking a bit of time out to do some reminiscing with us. Thank you so much for coming on.
Right.
Yeah, that was awesome.
It was a pleasure.